get going. This morning we have Commissioner Kadalka back and Buzzer and Commissioner and members, you might want to keep your conversations to yourself, as I believe we're on TV this morning. So we need to be on our best behavior. Welcome back, Assistant Commissioner Kadalka, and if you want to go back in, I think we did air with Assistant Commissioner Thornton. What's Assistant Commissioner, not Director, Assistant Commissioner Thornton, right. Go ahead, Commissioner, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Good morning, Committee Chair and Committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadalka. I am an Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with Land and Legislative Policy. I'm just going to start up real quick again. We're going to take up slide 27 from the handout.
Sorry, Commissioner. I have the minutes of January 21st. Representative Fisher, would you like to move those minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Discussion to the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Excuse me, Commissioner. Go ahead. Continue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just real quick, here's our vision out of our strategic plan. Each of the slides before each of the issue areas comes from our strategic plan. Again, making sure our land supports healthy ecosystems and sustainable land use, which is really a nod towards our cleanup program. We talked earlier about our dashboard and a number of metrics that the agency uses, and this is one that you'll see on there, and it's about how we handle solid waste in the state. The legislature and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency prioritizes how we handle waste, and the preferred or priority way is for waste reduction, reuse, recycling, and then composting. And once we've handled waste in that way, we are faced with a decision, do we send it to a waste energy facility or landfill? And we prioritize as a state a waste energy facility instead of a landfill because of the other benefits, energy production, and other outcomes. As you can see by the chart, our recycling rate is slowly moving up over the last 10 years. We're at about 48% when you combine organics and recycled materials. And a third of our materials are still going to landfill. Our concerns on this are not only environmental and public health because of landfill and long-term longevity of them, but also it's a missed opportunity in terms of economics. Currently, about 1.3 million tons of recycled materials are thrown away each year, and they value over $200 million. To add insult to that, we pay over $200 million to throw away that money or resource into a hole. So it's important for us to find ways to move it up the hierarchy into recycling and composting, because in Minnesota it provides 37,000 jobs, recycling jobs, and just under $2 billion in wages. And this includes companies across the state, from Godot Steel in St. Paul here to egg carton manufacturers in Moorhead, plastic lumber manufacturers in Jordan, Haynesville, and Worthington, and also recycled paper in International Falls, Duluth, and St. Paul. So as you can see, the benefits of these recycled materials, if we can keep them out of the landfill, stay in Minnesota by creating jobs and new products and provide less of an environmental footprint. So the question is then asked, what's still sitting in our trash that we throw away each day? And the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, about every 10 years or so, does a waste comp study, which really just characterizes what's in the waste. And as you can see here, our paper being thrown away is going down, but plastics and organics are moving up. Looking at this study, we can tell about 70% of what we throw away can still be recycled or composted. And about 40% of that is organics. That comes from the food materials that you classically think about as compostable, but also soil paper products that can't be recycled as paper, but rather could be composted. Another issue that our lands program...
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, again, thank you for your efforts on recycling last year. We passed that bill, as you know, Mr. Kadalka, to increase the goals. And I appreciate this study that you all did about waste composition. And I would just take slight issue with one thing that you said in terms of the hierarchy. I think it's becoming very clear that when you look at the waste stream, it's really problematic to both burn and landfill waste, you know, given the fact that, that all of those recyclables are being burned as well. And so we're burning up a lot of energy in terms of that. The energy that we get out of burning is a fraction of what we would get out of recycling. Of course, there's attendant environmental problems with that. So I hope the agency will really look at waste in a different way in terms of really moving us up seriously on the hierarchy, that we really get all of, as much of those recyclables and compostables out of the waste stream and really hit those goals that we established for the state last year, that, you know, look at about a 75% goal, at least for the metro area, and then there's other issues in greater Minnesota that we should deal with. But I applaud the agency for the study, for really moving up the organics piece. My question to you would be, what would be the strategies that the agency and Swim Club and others would be looking at in terms of collecting and processing those organics? Because I believe there's a good local market for those. We're now looking at 31% of the waste stream. And so if you could just outline maybe a little bit about your thoughts about, how do we get at that 31%? How do we really implement, curbside composting programs and other ways to get that out of the waste stream? You go to any restaurant, and to think that all of that waste is going to a landfill or an incinerator, it's just mind-boggling to me. We could be using that for agricultural purposes. We could be using that for transportation, roadbed improvements. So what are your thoughts about that?
I'm staying out of it. Mr. Kudalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for those comments. It really is, there's two ways to look at this. There's the collection of it, getting the materials out of homes and businesses that you talked about. And there are some industries that are moving forward. There's a company in the metropolitan area that has a blue bag program that would allow for organics or separated materials to be put in your trash in a blue bag, and once it gets to the transfer station, it's pulled out, making it easier for consumers to do that. A number of local units of government and others help with individual composting at homes by providing the materials. At our Eco Experience, we provide information on how you can make your own composting facility. But the other end is also making sure that we can improve the end market for it. And the agency just completed its composting rules, which allow still for environmental protection, but allow for easier siting and creation of composting facilities. Under the old rules, there was two options. There was what you would do with all the trash you get, and then what you would do with the yard waste. And we created a middle system that would allow for source-separated organics to be sited and operated in a manner that still protected public health and the environment, but would be easier because we know they don't have what's in the rest of the waste stream because there are less potential pollutants. So removing those barriers are going to help. A lot of it's education. It's changing how we act. It's getting composting bins in the places we live and work. And that's going to take a lot of education and changing people's behaviors.
Representative Hornstein's done. Commissioner Kudalka, to Representative Hornstein's question, don't most of the facilities that burn waste sort out the recyclables? Ones I visited had a sorting prior to the actual burning. Is that not standard procedure? Representative Hornstein mentioned about getting the recyclables out instead of burning them. I was wondering about that.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's a good question. There are processing going on before it goes in the waste energy facility. It does collect some valuable things, and some of them collect metal on the backside. But it could be improved. The best processing is done at the source, whether it's our homes or here in the office building where we do the sorting, so it doesn't collect everything. Our priority is getting it higher up the waste hierarchy. It's the recycling and composting. It's when that's not done and we're sitting with something in the trash can and it's the truck's got to send it somewhere, we prioritize waste energy over landfilling. But the end goal is to get everything higher up the hierarchy, as both representatives have mentioned, so that it would be recycled and composting. It's really waste energy versus landfilling is the lesser of two evils, so to speak.
Thank you, Commissioner Kudelka. Representative Hornstein, I'm going to suggest the Commissioner and Department of Admin keep you also in the loop. The general public, the cameras don't scan the entire room here, but nowhere in this room is there a recycling bin. There are a couple bins as you walk out the way, one for paper and one for cans. It doesn't tell you what to do with the empty coffee jug. Last night I had the maintenance lady, great lady, stop and said, should I throw that away? And I said, absolutely not. I said, if it was in my garbage, what would happen? She says, it stays in the garbage. It happens to have a number on it. I think it's number 4. I know the cover was number 4 because I happened to look at that to be sure the cover was okay to go. So we're going to, Representative Hornstein, at some time in the future, have some state-of-the-art cans somewhere in this room and in this building. And then after that, we'll have an opportunity to hear any bills that deal with recycling. To that point, Representative Hornstein.
And Mr. Chair, after you implored the Department of Administration our first meeting to do this, I did contact them. So they're certainly well aware of your concern and mine. So I really hope in short order they will at least provide these containers for our hearing room and perhaps others in the building. But certainly start here in room 5.
Well, and Representative Hornstein, my concern is what is their plan for the Capitol reconstruction in the new Senate office building? Have we properly prepared those two buildings to go to Commissioner Kudelka's building? Certainly has a much better rate than we do, and it's kind of sad that we actually are passing the laws here, and in this building, you actually, in this room, you have to leave the room to do any kind of recycling. So we're going to keep working on it, and my frustration, I'm holding it back this morning. There were a couple other people to this point. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, you've got some percentages up there that are very interesting. Can you give me kind of a rough idea of what's happened to overall volume during that same period of time?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I will need to get back to you on those numbers, on the overall volume of trash. But it's not going down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not going down. It's going up dramatically. I assume population has an effect on that.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. Population does have an impact on it, but I'll get you the numbers and the long-term trends for you.
Thank you.
And Commissioner, to that point, and Representative Torkelson, unfortunately, we're kind of stalled in about a percentage that we achieved decades ago, unfortunately. Granted, some things have improved and some of the waste has changed, but some percentages, unfortunately, aren't rising as fast as they could. And Representative Hornstein brings up the great opportunity in composting. So much of our stuff currently is going in the garbage that could be composted. And many of us that grew up with a family that had a garden, it was only natural to compost. So maybe we can bring some of that back. I bet Representative Clark knew about composting as a kid. No doubt about it. Interesting, we have a couple of Minneapolis legislators interested in composting. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And my question's on a little different topic. I was watching, I think it was Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs on cable, and they were tearing apart mattresses and recycling mattresses. And I was wondering if we have any programs or if there are any companies that are doing mattress recycling in Minnesota, because it would seem that that would be a huge volume if it's either going to the incinerator or if it's going to landfills. So do you, Commissioner, do you know if there's any mattress recycling going on?
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Sorry, there are. There's one company in Duluth that does that. We would like more capacity in the metropolitan area. A number of states have passed product stewardship for mattresses. The industry has supported it, and they're working out the program in other states. We've been in communication with them. And as they work out the kinks in other states, they have expressed interest to bring it to other states, and we will continue those conversations.
Commissioner Kudelka, in anticipation of Representative Clark to this point, we both had some facial expressions when Representative Hansen talked about that. The folks aren't using their bare hands for this type of operation, are they?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll need to get back to you, but
thank
it
you.
Is labor intensive.
Yeah, please do. Representative Clark, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I had some experience with a company that was doing mattress recycling in, it was in southern Minnesota, and I can't remember. This is probably about 15 years ago. But there was an OSHA complaint because it is a very dirty business tearing apart those mattresses, and there needs to be, you know, the workers who do it need to be protected. And, you know, that certainly would be part, I assume, of any business doing it in Duluth or elsewhere now. I mean, that was quite a long time ago, but and there are particular issues now with what's in mattresses that we need to be aware of. Some of the things that are put in mattresses by law, flame retardants that are endocrine disruptors, a few other things right now. We know we have a lot of bed bugs in a lot of our old mattresses. I mean, they're just things that it's the kind of work that needs to be done. We really appreciate the people who do it, and they need good health and safety protection when they do it.
Thank you. And unfortunately, I cut off Representative Hansen. You weren't done. Sorry.
Thanks, Representative Mr. Chair. Hansen. And the point on bed bugs is actually one of the reasons to handle mattresses differently, because you could stop that point of transfer by getting old mattresses killing the bed bugs and not having them being transferred places. So there's a couple other reasons that, and that's a huge issue. So I'll be interested to see if the agency comes forward with industry on product stewardship. I know on the last session we had some other product stewardship proposals, so looking forward to see what the agency is recommending.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my friends on the other side of the aisle are going to probably be surprised, but I do have a question for you, and it's a serious question. When I go to the grocery store and I'm standing there at the checkout, I always freeze up because the person at the counter always says paper or plastic. So you're the main guy in the state. Tell me what to say.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you should be bringing your own reusable bag.
Great answer.
But to your point, paper over plastic.
Commissioner Kudelka, a follow-up to that point. Assuming that either one of those is not going to go into the waste stream, do you know the answer to that, or do you want to get back to us? I mean, which of the paper or the plastic, if it's not going to go into the waste stream and it's going to be recycled?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. There are recycling efforts for both. The recycling efforts for paper bags are more evolved and developed than plastic. Plastic film is still difficult. There's less places for you to drop them off. But also they can create havoc if they're put in the wrong processing facility or at a recycling facility, because they can start getting into the gears if they're just floating around. So you're correct, we can recycle both. It's just easier to handle paper than plastic. And unfortunately, too many plastic bags are still blowing around.
Well, Commissioner Kudelka, and I respect that. Our carrier, the Tennis Brothers, want us to put all the comes every morning in the paper. I get one this time of year because they're worried the paper's going to be wet. And so we bundle them all up. That's the way they ask them to be put in, many of them, and push them together. Can you get back to us? I'm curious. I was under the understanding that if those are actually recycled that way, that there's a great percentage of energy recovery with that way. And I know that stores always encourage it because they must be substantially cheaper. I'm assuming that's some of their motivation. So if you could get back to that. At this point, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to applaud Representative Neuberger. You're a brave man for asking that question. I also want to say and advise that in support of the timber industry in this state and representative of a lot of that, paper is the way to go.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, you know, we talk a lot about paper or plastic, but what percentage of the stuff that I carry out of the grocery store that ends up being in the trash stream, what percentage of that is actually in the bag that I carry out?
Mr. Commissioner Kudelka, sorry.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's a good point. The packaging that we use is just as important as the bag, and so we really need to look at all the sources of it. And there are some companies moving forward to make their things in easier to recycle containers. For instance, a water bottle or that is much easier to recycle than a juice pouch. A juice pouch that I send my kids and others send to school with their kids aren't recyclable, so you're right. But there's more choices than just the bag we take the materials out in.
Thank you, Commissioner Kudelka. And we will have this back before us, especially in the budget time. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, one last follow-up question. Mm-hmm. What about these Mylar bags? Can you recycle those? What's the status on those? I mean, the little juice bags that you poke the straw through for your kids, or the Mylar bags that your potato chips come in. Are those recyclable? Enlighten me.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, each packaging is a little different, but a large number of juice container packages are not recyclable, those pouches. And so that is a concern, and that's something I know on a national level folks have been working on, including nonprofit organizations, to try to change that.
Thank you. Continue, Commissioner Kudelka.
One of the other large issues that the agency handles with under the land umbrella is our polluted sites cleanup. And one of the challenges that the state is facing that's relatively new is dealing with vapor intrusion. Starting in about 2009, the agency started looking at this issue for our Superfund programs and a couple years earlier on our petroleum cleanup programs. But vapor intrusion is a fairly new science compared to others. And what it is when there's a contaminated product, as you can see in our graph here, when the contamination gets down into the groundwater or into the soil, we would traditionally handle that cleanup looking at the soil, our people having interactions with it, and the groundwater. But we've now learned that a lot of the volatile organic compounds are actually volatizing in gas form and working its way up through the soil and into our buildings, which is a concern that we had not had or known about previously. And how this affects a lot of sites is, so traditionally in an urban area, we would do the cleanup. If a contaminant got into the groundwater, we would first look at how is that groundwater affecting folks. If they're drinking off a drinking water system, they were being protected because they weren't putting a well into the groundwater. And then we'd look and see if it's spreading or if it's going to surface waters. And if we could contain it and do some cleanup, that's where we'd end up being. However, we now realize that it also is creating this third problem. And an example of that is a year and a half ago, is with the General Mills site in the Southeast Como neighborhood, where we have gone back to an old site where we thought we were making progress on the groundwater and have learned now that there are more issues here. As a whole, now the agency is going back through all of our open cases, and that's where you see the bar chart on the top of the slide, where out of about 600 of our Superfund and other programs, we still have about half of them where we have concerns about vapors. And as you can see, we're working our way through there to make sure that we've handled it correctly and are protecting public health. This is also an issue with closed sites. We are also in the process of going back through those sites to make sure we are protecting the public. But this is a large challenge for the agency that's time and resource intensive. So the challenges that the land and waste area faces, we've talked about the first one already, and I'll go on to the next one, which is finding less toxic chemical options. We talked about cleanup, which is the most expensive part of our work. The best way to get at this is at prevention, and that's really helping using less toxic chemical options. And an example is spray booths, where if we can move to a water-based paint for auto body shops and other similar companies, they can not only save money, but find other advantages that helps them in their businesses and environmentally because of the potential there for other issues. The next one is Minnesotans are more conscious of what's in our food, but what's also in our products. when you buy food at the grocery store, you can look, you can see the ingredients, you can see if there are various things as nuts and others that folks are concerned. But if you pick up an article of clothing or a toy, you can't tell which chemicals are in there. So consumers are looking for ways and avenues to get that information. And that's where the Department of Health, Department of Commerce, and Department and our MPCA have been working to try to get more of that information out. And finally, we talked a little bit about vapor intrusion. And my commissioner is very fond of saying and ending presentations on what he once knew. And it's really a nod to that our understanding of contaminants is growing. As we're able to measure things in smaller doses and we have a better understanding of what's happening, we learn more and have to constantly change not only our cleanup actions, but also how we put things in the products. And an example of that is TCE, trichloroethylene, which was a degreaser used and still used in many settings, but a lot of the cleanup properties across Minnesota have this in the groundwater. And recently, because of additional data on cancer, but also long-term effects for cancer, but also short-term exposure during developmental stages, whether it's young children or development, we've lowered the Department of Health has lowered the health-based standard for drinking water from 5 parts per billion to now 0.4 parts per billion. That's a significant change, and that is going to result in us going back, looking at various folks' wells, and also communities are changing their wastewater systems. Two communities that are facing this challenge right now are Bayport and Spring Park in the metropolitan area.
Excuse me, Commissioner Representative Clark.
If you were done with that part, I had a question about what kind of agency initiatives might you have in terms of helping consumers know more about the toxic chemicals and substances that are in some of those consumer products you were talking about? What's it? Are there some agency-led initiatives this session?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are still putting together and finalizing the governor's budget and the agency's agenda, and we'll be unveiling that next week. We don't have anything I can share at this time.
Thank you. Okay. Continue.
Next, we're going to move on to the water, and again, it's our strategic plan, and this is the vision we have to make sure we support aquatic ecosystems and healthy communities and help the economy grow.
Commissioner, excuse me, can you just give a overview for members on how water works with where your authority is and your responsibilities, and then where, for instance, DNR or Bowser, might just a real quick sure. short. Thank you.
Chair and committee members, we'll do this on a really high level and we can get down to more details, but it's easiest to think about the MPCA dealing with water quality and surface water quality. When we're talking about and groundwater quality on a lot of issues, when we're talking about quantity, that's the Department of Natural Resources. When we start moving through and start looking at how do we improve our water quality and also protect it, so restoration and protection activities, those more traditional permitting and regulatory efforts are handled by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and a lot of the voluntary efforts and financial aid assistance go through the Board of Water and Soil Resources, DNR, and others to help with the activity. So it really is a joint effort by the agencies. We have an interagency clean water team that meets very regularly, that helps put together the recommendations for our governor's budget for the Clean Water Fund, but also working together to make sure we're on the same page when it comes to policy and other things that we're implementing. So for those who have been here before, you've probably heard a lot from us about our watershed approach, and it is a very important effort. Previously, the way the agency used to handle this is we would do water quality reports on individual lakes or reaches of streams or an individual pollutant, and we really have changed into a new systematic approach over the years where we're now working on a watershed level, because the pressures and the impacts being felt by a lake or a stream in the same watershed are very similar. So we're able to move along quicker and also address multiple pollutants by working on a watershed scale versus the individual lake or stretch of stream. As I mentioned, it helps us deal with multiple pollutants at once. It also reduces the length of time to complete our reports, and also provides a consistent and efficient and effective process for working with local stakeholders. Because of this change and also the benefit of the Clean Water Fund, the agency has moved from a cycle of 100 or 50 years to get around to all of our waters to do that monitoring and assessment to a 10-year scale. And that's where you see on the slide there is our progress as we started this in 2007, moving forward, working through about 10% of the watersheds each year. And this is part of our overall plan on how we handle water in the area. First, we do the measurement and assessment, which you see here, and then we work on planning. And one of our roles with that is our watershed restoration and protection strategies, otherwise known as RAPs, which really work and do what we are required to do under the Clean Water Fund, replacing the work of the TMDLs, which were the total maximum daily loads, which in a nutshell is a budget for a pollutants in a certain body of water or watershed. But with the RAPs, what we've done is moved to a system to be able to make sure the information is usable for Minnesota so that it's more about improving the waters in Minnesota than necessarily getting the information we need to EPA. As part of that planning process, a number of strategies are outlined that could help either with the restoration or protection of that watershed. And then that goes to the local units of government, whether it's a watershed unit, a county, a city, or a soil and water conservation district, where they create water plans. And under leadership of the Board and Water Soil Board of Water and Soil Resources, which you'll hear about a little bit more, they're moving to a one watershed plan so that they're working in collaboration and creating one plan across that watershed. So the state is now moving to a more systematic approach from state to local partnership and planning with dealing with water. And once we do that, we move on to the next important part, and that's the doing. And that's where on regulatory efforts, well, if it's a wastewater, municipal or industrial wastewater, we'll take that information and work that into our permitting. The same with stormwater. If it's voluntary activities, restoring stream banks or working on septic systems and also ag runoff, those are other programs such as Department of Ag, Board of Water Soil Resources, and others that move forward. So this is a continuing circle that we handle. We do the measuring and assessment, the planning, the doing, and then going back and measure to make sure and see if what we did made a difference. And that's what the last graphic here on the slide is about. One of the metrics for determining water quality is water clarity. As you can see, we're seeing about a fifth of our waters, we're seeing improvement in that area, which is encouraging for us. And some of that is by success stories we have out there. On our dashboard is one of our success stories dealing with wastewater treatment facilities and the Minnesota River on a graphic. But then there are also some things on the ground. And you see here are two examples that are being done by some farmers that are taking leadership in the area. A drain tile rerouted to a ditch to restore a wetland, and then cover crops being used to keep water and other soil and other materials on the land. But despite the good work I talked about before, there's much more to be done. And these are two examples of the type of situations we're seeing. The first there on the left is a picture of McLeod County where we have no protection, no buffers, no grass waterways, no cover crops, which has allowed for the water to run off the field, not only take the materials from there, but also start to deteriorate the water bank there, the stream bank. The other is a problem that we see more in the urban area. This was an enforcement case last year in Prior Lake with a home builder that just disregarded the stormwater laws. And when there was a heavy rain, a large amount of sediment washed down this area and into the body of water that you can see there. These are both the issues that we must still work on to get to where we need to be. This is one other example of a before and after. This is from our sampling and monitoring staff that went out this year to Buffalo Creek in April. And as you can see on the left, this is a good stream with good perennial vegetation protection. You see the buffers, you see the stream or the creek there meandering, which slows down water flow, because we know the faster water flows, not only is it pulling the issue of pollutants that are coming off the land, the speed and volume of the water is deteriorating stream banks, which is producing a large amount of sediment and contributing to the problem. Here you can see the creek is meandering, slowing itself down, it's making deposits. And then when our staff went back to do some other work there in the fall, the creek had been improved, and that's what they call it. But from a water quality perspective, these aren't improvements. We've lost the buffers. This is now a straight channel that will just send things straight down to the larger body of water it goes into. We have knowledge on how to improve stream systems, use two-stage design to protect water quality. We know how to provide good drainage and provide habitat that can benefit farmers and the environment and water quality. We know these best management practices, and while some have taken leadership to this, we need them to become the everyday practice, not just the best used by some.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kadelka, on that slide, was there any public dollars involved in that straightening of that ditch?
Mr. Chair, and
Commissioner Kadelka, do you need to get back to us on this? Because I have the same concerns. I'd like to know a little more about what happened here, how it could possibly happen.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we'll need to get back to you specifically on this reach and what was funding source.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was a similar question, like was there some local, approval that was needed? It's the same question, I think.
Thank you. I think of Renville County, and I think of the SWCD person out there. I'd sure like to know how it happened. So we all look forward to enlightening us on that specific slide. I had the same reactions when I saw the slide. The before and after were backwards. Continue. I'm sorry. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, just for the benefit of the people who are at the table here, who has jurisdiction over these things statutorily? Where does the responsibility lie? I mean, I can understand why some of these things happen at the local level, but what is MPCA's role in this?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to ask a colleague to come up, Galen Reitz of our Watershed District, to help me out with that one.
Mr. Reitz, if you could identify yourself for the record and answer Representative Fabian. Were you able to hear the question?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Watershed Division at the Pollution Control Agency. In this case, the local authority, this is actually a legal kind of activity of ditch improvements, and it's probably done under local ditch authority, which the benefited parties pay for the cost of the ditch improvement. I think our concern in this kind of situation is that we now have know of good design abilities to both make sure that water is moved, which that's the intention of these ditch improvements, but you can also do it in a way that can protect water quality in the design of how it happens, and this is an example that we wouldn't consider a good example of how water quality can be protected at the same time keeping the water moving off the land.
Representative Fabian, follow up, and then members, we're going to have this wrapped up with MPCA at about 10 after 9 so that we can get through Bowser, but we're on track. Representative Fabian.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka. I was kind of, as we've been going through your presentation here on the water quality, I was looking at the dashboard that you provided us. And one of the things I was kind of picking through here on is you had a graph on here showing phosphorus release in the wastewater flowing Mississippi River or the Minnesota River, how that was reduced. But I didn't see anything really showing what was happening in phosphorus that's coming from non-point sources or what's happening with nitrates and sediment loads coming out. And are there certain measurements that we have to meet from the federal standards, and how are we doing on trying to meet those standards?
Commissioner Kadelka or Director Reitz?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is one of the metrics. We have many metrics on this, and I'm going to turn over to the Division Director Reitz to talk about our nutrient strategies and some of our goals that address those points. From
Director.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what's shown in this slide, you're correct, is from the reduction in point source phosphorus And what we see is that we haven't really made improvements in terms of phosphorus from non-point to this point in time. And nitrate is going up significantly. And I think the good news is we actually have developed a nutrient reduction strategy that was initially driven by expectations of our contribution to the Gulf of Mexico and the hypoxic zone there. But I think our focus is really about protecting water in Minnesota, and then that will also result in improvements in the Gulf of Mexico from our contribution. But the nitrogen reduction strategy identifies what we need to do over in the future to reduce nitrate and that contribution. And I think the good news is we have the technology, we have the knowledge, we have the best management practices. Some of it is focused on not over-applicating nitrogen fertilizer. That's kind of the first line of defense, because it saves the farmer from that loss of the nutrients they put on their fields. Once it's lost from the cropping system, it's a cost to them, it's a cost to the public if we have to clean it up. There are perennial vegetation is something that can make significant difference. There are technologies of bioreactors that can be put in that actually treat the nitrate before it goes into ditches or streams. So the knowledge is out there that we can change the direction of the trends.
Follow-up, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my questions I had asked first time, I'm still looking for an answer to, is are there any higher regulations from the feds or anyone else saying that we have certain guidelines or goals that we have to meet in these areas?
Director Eads.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, from the federal government, the focus on hypoxia in the Gulf is really driving their direction to us in terms of reduction of nitrate, and so there isn't like an allocation specifically to the state. It's a request to the states to make every effort to reduce at this point.
Follow up, Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So if I'm understanding what you're saying is that right now there is a request for us from the state from the federal government to be doing a better job on managing these issues?
Director Eads.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Fisher.
Thank you. One of the questions I would have then is I'm hearing you mention that we've got a lot of best practices that are out there that we're making ground on. There's a lot of technology, but yet we're getting more and more it doesn't get better. It seems it's getting worse. What's being done, or what can we be doing to look at differently to address this part of the problem? If we've got the best practices out there and best availability, why isn't it going down?
Director Eads.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's the $100,000 question. You know, we with the Clean Water Fund, we have a great opportunity to make efforts. And everybody's working toward that end, but we need to up the ante and try and make further progress. I don't have the answer on why haven't we been able to turn the corner yet.
Thank you, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is back on the previous slide you had up there. This is obviously a man-made ditch. It's not a stream. Is that correct?
Director Eads or Commissioner
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, well, the fact that it's named Buffalo Creek, I would say that it started out as a natural waterway. Whether it now is classified as a public ditch, that may also be possible, because sometimes they still retain the name of Buffalo Creek even if they have a public ditch number.
why don't we include that confirmation when you get us more information on this situation? Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like that, and because you had referred to it as a ditch. Also, I'd like to know, and you can get back to us with this because we're running short on time, were these improvements made because they had tiled the fields? I see they've got kind of a riprap on the edge of this, which if this is a drainage ditch, may actually reduce the amount of sediment that runs off. And if it's coming in into this ditch through tile instead of overland, is there a reason for that? And so I just like the background on what happened here. And so thanks.
Thank you. Good point. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, this may be a question for
Excuse
you.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I missed it. Oh. Were you still, Representative Clark? I'm sorry. You're on the list. Yep. I've got you on the list. Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Commissioner, every year in these committee meetings, the government scares me just a little bit more. Right now, Representative Torkelson left here, but in our area, we have a lot of farm drainage and ditches and cleaning of ditches and CRP and buffer strips in my farm. I have to deal with the DNR, the Corps, the Watershed District, Bowser, NRCS, Blue Earth County Environmental Services, and it worries me. I've never heard the MPCA mentioned in anything like this before. And I just wonder, is it your intention to have veto authority or somehow are you going to be on the food chain now? And I don't mean that in a bad way. When we go to all these, we've been promising a one-stop permit process for 12 years since I've been here, and it's never happened. Are we going to add another layer on, will these people have to check with you before they engage in an activity like this? Is it going to be one more layer of government, or are you folks just in this because somebody asked you to be? And is it your plans in the future to be a veto authority over the local projects?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is part of the work we do on the monitoring and assessment of water body systems, and a big part of our job is putting out there what we're seeing happening on the land. And while we have a lot of authorities in terms of regulated industries, such as municipal wastewater or stormwater, industrial wastewater, some of this is done by local units of government. It's a partnership, and we'll work together with the other agencies on this. But this is what we're seeing, and one of the biggest ways that what we need is, as Galen has mentioned, is changing people's behavior, and the best way to do that is to educate people, and that is one of our strong roles that we're doing here today.
Follow-up, Representative Cornish.
Just back to the question, and are you going to be in the chain when we go in for buffer strips, ditch improvement, erosion along the riverbeds? Is the MPCA watching that, and can you put a stop to it? I mean, if you wanted to, do you plan that right now? Are you in it, or do you plan it for the future as being another layer that has oversight and can stop things like this? Even if it gets okayed from all these other places, but you see there's something wrong, do you have the authority to step in and stop it after it's been approved?
Director Reitz or Commissioner Kadalka, maybe you could talk about the role the NPDES permits play in your current authority and how that works. I'm assuming this would have needed an NPDES permit, and you have some authority in regards to enforcing and watching those permits. The previous slides of the residential one in Prior Lake, and I can't remember the other flip side of it, looked to me both like they were NPDES permit investigations you made. Director.
Mr. Chairman, members, in the case of if it would disturb over 5 acres, then there would be a requirement for an NPDES stormwater construction permit. But if it's under 5 acres, then there isn't that requirement.
Director Reitz, isn't it 1 acre? Isn't there? Yeah, it's 1 acre, actually. There's a nod in the audience. Cornish, follow-up?
No.
Oh, okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Reitz, what's the definition of disturb?
Mr. Chairman.
Director Reitz.
Members, I think the definition of disturbed would be removing all the vegetation, construction activities, basically using heavy equipment and moving soil such that there's no vegetative cover.
And Director Reitz, it doesn't include normal farming practices.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative Fabian, follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cornes kind of touched on what I was going to be talking about. In much of rural Minnesota, there's great frustration because of what he mentioned about all the different agencies that are involved in water. And a lot of people that I work with at the local level have serious concerns about water quality, and they are trying to do things that they think are some best management practices. And sometimes I think we do a disservice to our local officials when we show a slide like the one that you have here. Maybe the project's not complete. I see there's some black areas outside the riprap. Maybe there is some cover crop there. Maybe there are some intentions for some buffers to be put in there. As Representative Green mentioned, maybe there is drain tile here, and maybe that is a good way to do this. And I think that, you know, if we truly are concerned, and Representative Fisher talked about it, seems to be getting worse. Well, in some cases, it maybe is. I read a report in the newspaper in the past few days about the Rainy River up in my district and the increase in the number of lake sturgeon in there because the water quality has improved. I think that some people have the opinion that our water just continues to get worse and worse and worse and worse, and to the contrary, I think it's getting better. Can we still make some improvements? Absolutely, but I think that we need to make sure that as we move forward, we can't have six or seven different agencies involved in this stuff. It's very, very frustrating to a lot of local people. If we could streamline the process, I think we'd get a whole lot more buy-in into all this stuff in rural Minnesota in particular, because you would make it easier to buy in. But now you get contradictory opinions. One agency says, yes, go ahead with the project, and this is a good way to do it, and the next agency says, no, you can't do it that way. So my statement is let's get on the same page on these things, and let's make it easier for people to be in compliance.
Thank you. Continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's maybe a question for a longer discussion. It is about the issue of wastewater. You have that as wastewater infrastructure question here, and I remember I was just looking at my notes from when you talked before. I really didn't ask you a question then, but are we going to have more discussion about wastewater from the agency? I mean, I would like some more, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if that's in your plan, but it's a kind of a, it does affect the waters, it affects the lands, it affects agriculture, it affects everything, and I'm just wondering if we can hone into that a little bit more, maybe even a little more explanation of what this slide means when it says wastewater infrastructure.
Commissioner Kudelka, to that point.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe you're talking about that third bullet here on the slide here. These last two bullets really talk about, well, we've been blessed in Minnesota with the Clean Water Fund, and we've been able to do good things and have seen in areas where there have been improvements in water quality and some areas where we have not seen improvements. We can't buy our way out of this. The demand in the area of wastewater infrastructure is very large. The list that's compiled by the agency and that is then used by the Public Finance Authority, PFA, to do wastewater infrastructure is very long, and there needs to be other activities done, changes between you and I in an urban area on what we put into the wastewater system. One of the issues we could talk about is chlorides. But then there's the same is also the case in runoff areas, whether it's a parking lot or in an agricultural setting, that money alone, paying for folks to do the action is not going to be enough. There's going to have to be changes in behavior. And part of that first step is education and making sure folks are aware of the problem so that we can move forward and create those plans.
Thank you. Representative Hand, I'm sorry, Representative Clark, did you have follow-up?
Well, just, Mr. Chair, maybe it can be a discussion. I could start with the agency separately, but I'm concerned about some of the products of wastewater that are, we just haven't talked about them, things that, you know, sludge and so on that gets taken from our cities, for example, with a lot of things in and out to the farmlands and put on as if it's a really good thing. There's questions about that. And so I just, and how that impacts eventually the streams and waters and stuff. So maybe that's a discussion I can start to have, and maybe you and I could talk about if we have more good opportunity for that.
Good points and good questions. Thank you. Observations, Representative Clark. Last question, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we'll be hearing about from Bowser next in terms of how the public, all the public in the whole state, pays for the practices, the cost share, the voluntary effort that we've been spending tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on to try to get people to do the right thing. All of us, whether we're in metro or suburban or rural, hundreds of millions of dollars to entice people to do the right thing. Now, Mr. Kadelka, I think earlier you talked about regulations in the metro area, that when there's stormwater problems or whether there's erosion problems or whether there are incorrect design problems, the people who do that get fined. There's a regulatory component. Is that correct?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, there are regulatory programs, like you said, for municipal industrial wastewater facilities, just like there are for feedlots.
So,
Representative Hansen.
Representative Fabian, when the water gets better, it's because we've, in many cases, regulated the businesses, regulated the cities, taxed the metro cities to pay for the wastewater treatment in their areas, paid them the property taxes for it. Not best management practices, not cost share at 75% to entice people. I started working in this area in 1988, and we had the Groundwater Protection Act, which was a voluntary effort. So 25 years we have been shoveling money to people to do the right thing. What I've learned is there are people who you cannot reach that will not do the right thing, even if you pay them. And that's the discussion we're going to have. Nobody's pure in this, and we're going to have some other tools. When we're catching speeders, we don't pay them to do the right thing and educate them. We have police on the road that catch them when they are speeding, and we penalize them. But we refuse to have that discussion. We refuse to have that discussion when it comes to non-point pollution. So we can spend another 2 years and shovel another $200 million out there, and it will make an impact. But it's not going to solve the problem.
Thank you. Representative Kadelka, can you walk through the last four or five slides here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, our last issue is assistance in operations. And again, our strategic plan and our vision statement for it. One of the operational metrics we do, I mentioned, I believe, earlier in the presentation, that we do a strategic review of our metrics and then an operational each year. And one of those is permitting. And because of a lot of work done over the last 4 years by members of this committee with House File 1 and the executive order in 2001, we have a 150-day goal for permitting of various types, from wastewater to construction stormwater to feedlots. And during that time, since 2001, for our priority permits, which are construction permits, which are the ones for someone to build a new facility, expand a facility, or need an okay to move forward with something, since 2011 and the executive order, we're at 97% at that 150-day goal. And the last year for those priority permits, we're at a 99% meeting that goal. Last year, legislation was passed where we would create another tier of a 90-day goal for about 75% of our permits. That is being implemented starting January 1st, so that's just up and running, and we hope to have some time to implement that. The last piece I just want to really quickly highlight here, and not take too much more time, is the assistance programs. Assistant Commissioner David Thornton talked about the diesel retrofit program. That's one example of the financial assistance that the agency works with private and public partners on. The other is technical assistance, and that's RETAP and MNTAP. That's the Retired Engineers Technical Assistance Program and the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program run by the University of Minnesota. These operations go into businesses or others that would like them to come in voluntarily, go through their systems and provide them information on how they can make improvements, efficiencies, not only help the environment, but also their business operations to speed things up or save money. This is a very valuable resource that the agency itself has used to improve its own activities, but a number of businesses have also. With that, Chair and committee members, I'd like to wrap it up. Just a reminder of the legislative contacts for the MPCA and how to get a hold of us. In addition to that, we will be bringing on Gretty Gauthier. She will be the another contact here and the main lead for the legislative duties starting on Monday.
Thank you, Commissioner Kudelka. We appreciate you coming in. Director Jasky, if you could come forward, and we'll move into the Bowser presentation for the rest of the hour. Welcome. You could identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. John Jasky, Executive Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I'm here today to do our agency overview. Before I do that, I just want to let you know why I'm here all by myself. It's a little lonely at Bowser right now because our Deputy Director, Sarah Stroman, who many of you got to know over the last couple of years, is moving on to the DNR to become the assistant commissioner in a week or so. So, Sarah, can you wave your hand? She's very bright, very strong-willed, and a high conservation ethic, and she makes everything that I've seen her do get better and make people feel better doing it. So that's a pretty high endorsement. So the DNR is going to have someone terrific in their midst. So we'll miss her, but we'll be looking forward to working with her. So. Meanwhile, we'll have some other folks helping me out, and some of them are here, and we'll get a chance to have them in front of you at different times during the upcoming months and hearings. With that, I just want to give a little bit of background about myself. We were asked to give a little bit of a personal background. I won't spend too much time on it, but I grew up in Morrison County in central Minnesota on this farm, and I live currently in St. Paul on an old city street. And we had good neighbors on the farm. We have good neighbors in the city, and I, you know, the lot that I live on now could entirely fit within the dairy barn that I had on the farm I grew up on. You know, I'm not sure which piece of land had more runoff, actually. I think on a per unit basis, clearly my lot now that's got a roof and a sidewalk and a garage roof, it contributes more water leaving the property. You know, the farm that we had was a dairy farm, so we had a lot of grassland because of the need for hay and pasture and things like that. But, you know, we also had corn and we had other crops that were growing to feed the cattle and to use for other purposes if it came to that. The one thing that is different is that in the city, you know, we do have the ability to manage water collectively more so because we have, you know, a stormwater system that's been built and designed over years to do that, because the nearest water body to my house right now is the Mississippi River, and there's nothing in between because, you know, 80, 90 years ago, all of that was eliminated when they built the infrastructure of the streets and the alleys and all of that. There's a stormwater pond, I think, on the St. Catherine's campus, but that's the only water you see from my house all the way to the river. So all that storm sewer, you know, many years ago was retrofitted to some extent to treat it a bit more than it was. You know, they used to allow all of the roof drains and so forth to go right into the storm sewer, the sewage treatment sewer, and they separated all that, of course, you know, many years ago. But we pay a fee to the city to manage our stormwater as a city resident. We do also have a watershed district that includes part of the St. Paul area and many other parts of the state that also collects revenue through the property tax system to help manage that collectively. So different approaches are needed in different places because what the land is the way we got to work with it. You know, my first job, I think, was really farm labor, number one, because we had a dairy farm with, we also had sheep. And I was the eldest of 11 children, so we had lots of farm laborers. But, of course, you know, we all didn't like the labor necessarily, so we always tried to find ways to get out of it by asking, you know, my parents if we could do other things like, you know, go fishing or go hunting or go play baseball and things like that. So it was good to have a team approach because if one of us wanted to do something else, we could maybe talk the other one into trading a deal and doing something fun while the other one did the work. But And we also had a horse, but the horse was not very helpful. In fact, one of the best memories of my childhood was when the horse left and the mini bike showed up to replace the horse, because we used to go use the horse to go try and corral the cattle, which the horse wasn't very good at, and we weren't very good at, you know, working with the horse either. But the mini bikes worked much better. So that was a good day on the farm when we got rid of the horse and got the mini bikes. But
I think Ms. Zipko would take exception to that. But
I think she might agree that, Mr. Chairman, that the horses don't bring any revenue to the place. They pretty much take it all away from the place that they're at. So
proceed.
And then you can see the rest of my, there's some things that aren't in here, but I worked for the DNR in two different parts of the state, you know, a number of years ago, and then I came to Bowser actually in the early 90s to work on the Wetland Conservation Act, a new law that was passed back then, and then left for a few years and went and worked for Dakota County at the local level as their water resources manager, and came back to Bowser in 2007. So, and I've been all around, I've been to every county seat in the state, every state park twice, so I've been all over the state and in and around, so I've got to meet a lot of really good people. We, of course, work at the local level, and so I've been able to make my presence, you know, in their backyard, you know, not as often as I'd like to, but I do think that it's important to be able to understand what people are dealing with in the places they're dealing with it. I went to University of Minnesota. And then I later on went back to University of Minnesota Mankato and got another degree. So that's my background. Any questions about that, feel free. With that, I'll move into our agency overview. We have a mission statement that describes the way we do all of our programming and our authorities that are in statute as well. We have everything set up to work with local organizations, local governments specifically, and we do that because our work is really focused on the private lands of the state, the conservation on private lands. You know, the DNR, by and large, handles all of the public land management responsibilities in the state, and so we often work with them, of course, because things leave and come into public lands, but we work with local governments who work with local private landowners. We also work with a number of private organizations too, you know, NGOs and private contractors and so forth. We've got partnerships with Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Land Trust, Nature Conservancy, Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa. So there's a number of those that are part of the programming that we have and the things that we are responsible for. Our agency is relatively small. I mean, we, you know, that's because it can be and needs to be, because we use the local government staff. We have about about 100 staff, and they're dispersed around the state. But we use the local expertise at the county soil and water conservation district, watershed district, and even city and township sometimes to get the work done. That system has been in place for decades, and it's getting obviously better and hopefully growing, but there are some fiscal challenges that we'll talk about a little bit later too with that network. We have a board that includes agency members, but also local government officials, county commissioners, soil and water conservation district supervisors, watershed district managers, city officials, and even a township member. And we also have a citizen membership on that board, and I'll show you where they are located next. We talked about the private land focus, and also, you know, really our focus is on the ground work, you know, getting conservation projects on the ground, working with those private owners. The structure of the board is set up as a 20-member board. These members are appointed by the governor. They serve 4-year terms. They're around the entire state. And they have, we have meetings about once a month, and, you know, typically have, you know, a full agenda each month. The things that the board does is they are responsible for rulemaking when that authority is needed. They're responsible for grant making. The appropriations that you provide to our agency are then sub-allocated to local governments through that board process. They also have responsibility for oversight, you know, things like audits and so forth that we're subject to or we subject to others. So we have that meeting once a month, and it's, you know, everything we do is a public process because we have to run it that way by statute. The board meetings are open meetings. All of our documents, you know, have to be posted, and so it's run a lot like a local proceeding would be, where you have public notice and a public venue for all the decision making. We have staff around the state. We have our central office is located in the DNR and MPCA Bowser Complex over in Lafayette Road. And that's been a very good thing. We've often been visiting, of course, with Department of Health and Agriculture, too, at their building. But we have field offices in the areas around the state, from Bemidji to Duluth, Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Marshall, Newell, Mankato, and Rochester. We have staff co-located in those offices with other agency staff, and that's been very, we purposely endeavor to do that, both for efficiencies of space and infrastructure, but also to give folks the best chance to work together in those in more informal settings. The statutes that we administer are all going to be tied in some way, shape, or form to local governments. There are 89 stormwater conservation districts, 46 watershed districts, of course, 87 counties, and we have 19 metropolitan WMOs, which are a specific form of joint powers agreement governments in the metropolitan seven-county area, which is comes from a law that was passed back in 1982.
Director Jaski, excuse me. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts, just a quick lesson on how those are established for some of our newer members, maybe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and actually the Water Districts, too, to a little bit different process. They're formed through petition to locally that comes to the state of Minnesota. Our agency creates these organizations, you know, when that petition is filed and if their findings are such that one is needed. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts then, and they've been around, you know, I think we've had statewide Soil and Water Conservation Districts since, I think the last one may have been formed in about the 1960s, so they've been around for a very long time. They are a local elected body that, you know, citizens vote for. And they have a five-member board typically, although I think a couple of them are going to be going to seven in a metropolitan area. And they're statewide. There's one in every county, and a couple counties have two because of a large size. St. Louis County and Polk County and Ottertail County each have two, because of a kind of east-west or north-south because of the size of the county. The watershed districts are formed by petition really for a more specific purpose, and they are not statewide. They are formed on a watershed basis across county boundaries typically, and they are set up with a plan that dictates the work that they will be doing and the authorities that they are going to exercise. So hopefully that's a little bit of background, but I know there's folks in the audience that can also help provide you with more information about each of those local government functions.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jaski, on that point, I think there are some districts that are kind of moving towards hybrids with their county organization, or and I think we passed some legislation about consolidation because of difficulties with getting funding from their counties. So if there were two soil and water districts or two watershed districts and they wanted to merge, or they wanted to merge with their county apparatus, are they penalized because they would lose their funding? For example, if there's two districts and they each receive X amount of dollars from the state and they became one, they wouldn't get both. There's no benefit financially from the state or from the county for merger or consolidation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, there is no benefit. However, in a couple of cases that it's occurred already, what we've done is provide a transition so that the funding that was coming to that geographic area would remain the same for a few years and then slowly decrease, you know, if that's what had to happen. And later on in the presentation, we'll talk about the overall need, and I think that's the bigger issue than, you know, specifically what happens in one county. But the answer to your question, Representative Hansen, is that yes, there could be a diminution, and likely would be unless there was new state resources put into it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Jaski, one way of doing some reform would be to incent providing a benefit to merge if they're unable to continue, rather than losing the district or losing the losing those services.
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you're right, there was legislation passed a year or two ago that allowed them to do a merger when it made sense for the conservation mission of their two or more organizations, and the citizens, of course, would need to support that. The counties are not obligated statutorily to contribute to the Stormwater Conservation District. Many of them have done that, I would say most have done that to different degrees. I think, again, I'll come back to my point a little bit later in the presentation about the combination of state and local funding that it takes to have the district operate, because they don't have their own ability to generate revenue. So, and both of those have been declining is the issue. And so I think it's going to take both of those things to be improved in the future if we're going to have them be fully successful.
Thank you. Continue, Director Jaski.
I'll come to this. This is a very broad summary. There's many details in the statute, and perhaps some of those will be more important as we get into different bills or budget issues. We have the authority to create, and in some cases disband the Soil and Water Conservation Districts or Watershed Districts or WMOs. And the WMO is a entity only within the 7-county metro area. It's a joint powers of cities and townships, or in some cases where they have not been able to create that, a joint powers agreement, the county would take on that responsibility in the metropolitan area. Our agency creates those organizations. We establish the boundaries and adjust boundaries as necessary to make sure that what they're doing is conforming with the, in the case of watersheds, particularly the changes on the landscape that may have happened with, different projects that have changed boundaries. Sometimes we, have water moving across boundaries. We've got to adjust for that. We, in the case of all three of these organizations, have a requirement for a plan to be developed, and then the state approves that, and then the local organizations adopt it. Those plans typically range from, 5 to 10 year lifespan, and they have a variety of things in them. The primary things are, the priority actions they're going to take and how they're going to accomplish those. The science that they use to just make those decisions or determinations comes largely from other sources. The MPCA is one of those sources, certainly, for the water quality work. We have other things that they also use to develop those action plans to clean up water, provide flood protection, habitat improvement, et cetera. The funding...
Representative Heintzman has a question.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski. This is kind of alluding to a discussion we had earlier, but I wanted to ask you. You just mentioned that you have authority to allow some of these organizations, like watershed districts, to change. I happen to have served on a watershed district, as we were discussing the other day, and this particular watershed district was formed in 1972 in response to an issue that was seen in that area, and over time the situation has changed significantly, and they have been searching for projects and things of that sort, and there has been some talk of maybe their mission has been fulfilled, maybe they are not necessarily necessary in that particular area. Is Bowser opposed to, in these kinds of situations, working to maybe remove that level of government?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintzman, I think that what you're describing is a process in the current law. There's a process to create a watershed district, and a process to dissolve a watershed district, and that is, both of them are stimulated by local petition processes. So. And once those petition processes are undertaken, then our agency's responsibility is to conduct findings and ultimately render a decision about that. And there have been a number of adjustments to watershed district, boundaries and or organizational existence. We've had both watershed districts created in the last few years. I think in the last 10 years there was one that was dissolved. But much more commonly, their boundaries are changed or they do some other adjustments to make sure that their plans and their priorities are lined up with the citizens' interests.
Follow up?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski, I appreciate that. So I guess what I'm hearing is in the right situation, you know, maybe where a organization like this particular watershed district might have outlived its usefulness, Bowser would be interested or working with local units of government to eliminate that organization.
Dr. Jasky?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we would respond to a petition. We would make findings based on what the petition was suggesting. We would have to make conclusions based on the issues that the citizens identified, as well as the resource issues that were going to be otherwise addressed by another way, which I think would be the simplest way to describe it. It's not a common occurrence, but I will say I know you've told me that you had to resign because of your new responsibilities here to make sure you didn't have that conflict, but it's a little bit unusual because of the way it was set up. I agree it was a very special purpose organization, but many of them are. Many of them have become much more comprehensive in their approach, and I think that's what we're hoping for. We'll have to talk about that one specifically, I think, on its own merits or its own issues.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jensen, so one last question. So I guess what I'm hearing, just for clarification, is that if a petition comes to your organization, to Bowser, and it is the will of the district or the folks in that watershed district to remove that layer of government, that it is that is the process, and that would be something that would be taken very seriously, and that could be eliminated.
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, it would be a unique set of findings. The main thing would be, I think, is there a better way to do more than they're currently doing for the purpose they were set up for? And if that's the case, and we look at the alternatives and someone else is able to do it, that may be an option, but it would be case by case.
Representative Heinzman. I think he's drilling down here a little bit.
Mr. Chair, yes. Mr. Jansky, is that a yes or a no? I guess I couldn't tell.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it's neither, because it is a proceeding that has to occur, and I don't have enough information to understand exactly what the proposal is or what the issues are, and I certainly wouldn't want to, you know, make some judgment about that before the proceeding before our board occurred. So I think we'll...
I guess I'm asking the question with the presumption. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, mm-hmm. Mr. Pajansky. I'm asking the question, I guess, with the presumption that process would have been conducted and that the will of people would have been exercised.
Dr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, because it's a legal proceeding that hasn't yet happened, I would like to just defer my answer on that to a point when I can get more information about that specific situation. Maybe I can come and talk with you about it, because I just don't know enough about
I'm just going to suggest maybe an offline conversation would be good on this one. Thank you. Anything else? Proceed, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so, back to this chart here, you know, we approve the plans regardless of what form of local government they are. We'll talk more about how those plans are being built in another way for the future, at least the way we're anticipating it on a more of a watershed basis across the state. The funding, you know, for these organizations comes from several sources, the state being a primary one for the soil and water districts, to some extent for the counties as well. And the watershed and WMOs, you know, they get some state funding, but they also have the authority to generate their own revenue, which is, you know, the base that they are using to leverage funding from other sources. We have a responsibility in statute to provide a performance assessment of local organizations that are doing water management. That statute came into being about 6-7 years ago. We've been doing that and posting those performance assessments on our website for now, I think, 5 or 6 years, and we've got a responsibility to get them all done within 10 years, and I think we're a little bit behind on that because of some funding issues, but we've been working on it methodically, and it's been very helpful because not only is the performance assessment provided, but there's assistance that comes with that, so it's a way to both evaluate and help, and it's been very, very effective, and, you know, I think not only dealing with a problem here or there, but more importantly, staving off problems that could have occurred otherwise, and I think that's been a good thing. We also have program oversight for a variety of things, which I'll talk about later, that all of these organizations are responsible for. I probably alluded to some of these things already that we have as the core functions. you know, we do address soil conservation issues, and we'll talk more about that as I get further in the presentation. We talked about the private land focus. All of our programs are really aimed at that through local governments as the responsible party that works with those landowners, by and large. The third bullet point here is really important because the resources the state has to bring to the work of the federal government or their resources or private sector or local resources is really, really important. Those plans that I'd mentioned that those organizations use to guide their work, they're looking for revenue from all these sources, and one of the best things they do is pull it together and get the things that are commonly sought by these different sources to be realized in singular projects or singular programs that they can deliver. I know Representative Cornish asked about, you know, I think the an issue with a drainage ditch or some such thing, but we do have the local conservation offices available for assistance to landowners, and they do that regardless of what the issue is. They'll typically be able to sort it out as kind of a one-stop shop, at least for information. The permitting might get more complicated than that, as he was alluding to. We talked about the water management programs that the local governments have, and I'll talk to you more later about the future that we're trying to get to on that. That's a little different than where we're at today. We have a responsibility in statute to resolve conflicts, and of course, it seems like around water there are a number of them. Some of them are explicitly handled through appeals. Some of them are handled through dispute resolution, which is a statutory responsibility of our board. And many, many, many more of them are handled informally at the local level by getting people together to understand something better and figure out a way to work through it. So that is something we spend a good bit of time on. The board is a venue for citizens and others to come in and raise their concerns. You know, sometimes they don't always, you know, feel like they're successful because it's not something we can always do about every problem we're asked to take a look at, but the board is there for that purpose, and certainly the local organizations, the county boards, the soil and water boards, and the watershed district boards are also a forum for people to express their issues and ask for things to be done if that's what it takes to make a difference. The Wetland Conservation Act, we administer that again through local authorities and others. We'll talk more about that in a bit. And also, we do facilitate the drainage policies in the state. The project that was put up on the screen earlier is into that category, and I'm sure you'll get more information about that. But drainage and water management, you know, have been for a very long time a separate set of things, and I think they can probably be put together a little better than they are for the future. And I think that's an example of what you saw in that picture. So some of our strategies, you know, I'm going to just show you some pictures and talk. I don't even really have a script here, so you know, if I screw it up, I guess we'll have to correct it. But you know, this
remember
is
you're being recorded too.
Well, I've been known to make a mistake.
We all are, for that matter.
Mr. Chairman, so this is just one example. I'll show you a couple of examples, and you know, and I can, you know, these are real places here in Minnesota, certainly. But if you know, the picture in the background is an aerial image of a landscape that's had, you know, additional tie line installed. And this, all of this is legal, right? It's happened many places long ago, and it's happening in some more places today and tomorrow. You can see there that tile pattern has been designed so that it avoids this wetland area. That's required by state law. It's also required for, in this case, a landowner that's an agricultural producer to remain eligible for federal farm program benefits. So we've got procedures we've worked out with USDA to try and coordinate that. Now, one of the challenges, of course, is that the USDA data is private data, so we have to work through the landowner to get it, or they have to authorize us to have access to it, because otherwise it's not available to anyone other than the producer. In this case, this is, you know, this is moving water off the land more effectively, and the reason for that, of course, is there's proven yield increases for that, right? That land is more predictably able to be cropped, and you know, does that means that there's more water going somewhere else, and so that's some of the things that we're trying to figure out, you know, ways to address. And by and large, we know how to do it. You know, if we're going to plumb the landscape a bit, we have to build some places in to do storage and treatment, and here's an example, you know, of a wetland restoration that was built not right immediately on this site where the tie lines are going in, but we're able to hold water, you know, to get water quality treatment, to get flood control benefits, to get habitat benefits. And where we put these wetland restorations is really in places where it's the most marginal land for anything else. I mean, it's the soil that's not good for production. It's the low part on the landscape, and we do that by and large by doing conservation easements to, you know, buy the land rights to hold the water here. And we have to make sure that all the tile lines and anything else that's coming into this are going to still be fully functional, because it's a legal responsibility to make sure that people have the right to move their water around as the current laws allow. So, you know, moving water off the land is important, but holding water on the land in critical places is also really, really important to make sure we're not causing harm downstream. As I mentioned before, we do this, you know, with our local government partners, because they spend time literally in people's yards, in their houses, you know, on the hood of their truck, trying to talk to them about what's possible. And a lot of this work is done and can be done voluntarily, not all of it, mind you, and there's going to be cases where, you know, we have to look at other alternatives. You know, the picture on my left, I guess yours too, is a Conservation Corps. One of the programs that we've got is set up with the Conservation Corps to get these young people who have an interest in this work to, you know, kind of be mentored by others who are doing the work or have done the work for a long time. And I don't know if Len Price is here or not, but we've worked with him and his organization to get these people doing real work on real projects with somebody who's done it before, so they can be our future to help a lot of this work get done, you know, down the road, because we got a long future ahead of us in conservation. The picture in the lower right is a ditch project. What they're trying to do here, or they are doing, with the contractor there, you know, on the left, and the local government person on the right, trying to install a controlled drainage system so that, you know, with more technology, we can allow the water to move off the landscape when necessary, but also to hold more water on the landscape in the soil profile when it's needed, or when it can be more slowly released downstream, so that we get the sort of the best of both worlds. Now, that technology is still in evolution. You know, putting it everywhere overnight isn't going to be possible, but more and more of that is something that we've seen designs, techniques, approved practices to accomplish those multiple benefits. Another of our strategies, of course, is dealing with the regulatory aspect of protecting wetlands. And this law that Minnesota passed back in 1991, the Wetland Conservation Act, does that. One of the things that law requires that you avoid or minimize impacts to wetlands, and when you can't, and that does happen because there are projects, you know, building roads or driveways or commercial development or even, you know, agricultural drainage is going to eventually impact a wetland that can't be avoided. And so we have a permit program, in essence, set up through local governments to do all of that. But one of the things that we did, you know, for maybe one of the first in the country, was build a wetland banking program where a wetland that is impacted, a small part of a wetland, can be offset by acquiring credits from a site where we built a wetland to offset those losses someplace else. And those are permanently protected areas that will be functioning as a wetland forevermore. And that's actually become a more effective approach than anything else in some ways, because when we ask someone to try and make a wetland or offset it themselves, it's very difficult to do that. You know, road authorities only can work in a road right away. You know, a development site, you know, there's not much room left to build another wetland if they had to fill one. So putting the wetlands in a place they're going to be long-term sustainable through that mitigation program has been, I think, very successful.
Director Jasky, on the wetland easement areas, when you put that into that bank, and let's just say it's in, pick a county, I don't care, does the county and the other taxing authorities in the area retain any of the property taxes in that, or does that become non-taxable land?
Mr. Chairman, all of the conservation easements that we take for the mitigation sites and for our Reinvestment Minnesota program, the ownership remains with the property owner, and they pay property taxes on that property as it's assessed.
Proceed.
And again, I mentioned, you know, these buildings look familiar, although the one across the street here looks not as good as it does in this picture right now with all the work going on. But one of the most important aspects of this local conservation delivery system is that we can bring in state, local, and federal resources to one place or one project in a way that couldn't otherwise be accomplished. And you know, we have funding that comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It comes from the Corps of Engineers. I know that other agencies seek funding and get it from, you know, other federal sources. You know, FEMA, we've heard about that lately because of the flood response, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, the DNR, works with them, and Forest Service, PCA works with EPA. So we, and they help with this as well, those agencies, trying to get as much federal money to Minnesota as we possibly can. That's you know, a big part of our job is to make sure we can do that, because you know, I don't know what the number is, but Minnesota probably gives more than we get from the feds, but we want to get as much back as we possibly can, particularly in the conservation area, because that money is really, really helpful, and it's many times more than the state or any local government would have, so we want to make sure we do that. This is budget information that I'll review in kind of a gross scale, because I know we're going to get into this more as the budget's released and we have hearings about that. This just describes the sort of the pie chart of the where the funding sources come from. This is, you know, just for the last biennium. You know, whether that's typical, I guess it probably is at this point. You know, but the key thing here is, you know, if you look at the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund, you know, those are funds that we didn't have, you know, a few years ago, and they also are conditioned on being supplemental to everything else that we were doing prior to that and continuing on. Those dollars are for projects that go to the ground in both cases, and we'll talk more about those in upcoming hearings in this committee, and I'm sure in Representative Erdahl's committee. We also get a bit of funding, you know, which varies each year from the Environmental Trust Fund through the LCCMR process. Those are typically one of a kind short-term projects. Bonding funds, you know, is, of course, those are variable to a great extent. The two programs that we've gotten and need to continue to get funding for in that area are the Reinvest in Minnesota Easement Program to restore wetlands and buffer areas, and the responsibility we have in statute to replace wetlands that are impacted by local road authorities. That statute requires that we do that on behalf of counties, townships, and cities who are building roads, that we build the wetland replacement for them, and that funding has typically come from the bonding source. And I know there's a transportation funding increase that's being pursued, so if that happens, we're going to have to find a way to make sure we got enough money to make more of the wetlands that are going to be potentially impacted. And the general fund, which has, you know, been declining, I mean, not only in total but in portion of the pie, is something we'll talk about more in a little bit as well.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. You had mentioned that on the conservation easement that remains taxable to the counties. I'm sure it's dependent somewhat on what land was mitigated, but in general terms, are the tax rates on the wetland bank, do they remain sufficient to reward the counties in that sense, or are they diminished?
Rick Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hancock, you know, I have to get some more information, but I would say this, that, you know, the areas where we have the easement is a sub-component of a tax parcel, so we aren't, in almost every case, an easement over an entire parcel or as a tax, as property taxes are described. I think it can go both ways. It sort of depends on what we started with. You know, I mean, if you had a piece of land that was marginal but attempted to be cropped, for example, and now it becomes a wetland, what the differential is, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Each assessor has their own method. Now they take direction from the Department of Revenue, certainly on that. But because they're almost always subcomponents, you know, they're strips along a river or they're a wetland in the middle of another larger tax parcel, it's pretty hard to tease out exactly what the change is. But we can come and talk with you more about that and how we've seen it work in a few examples, but I don't have that information real handy with me. So I'll come speak with you about that.
Representative Hancock? Director Jasky, too, I'm kind of curious on that issue. So Representative Hancock has some land. He decides to enroll it into the wetland bank easement program. He continues to pay property taxes. What does he get for income out of that 100 acres or whatever it was?
Mr. Chairman, the way it works under the wetland banking program is a landowner voluntarily decides they put a wetland back, and then they are becoming basically a wetland banking credit entrepreneur, and they sell credits to those who need to buy some. What the state does is we set up that's basically a brokerage, but we don't have anything to do with the price. That's between the buyer and the seller. All we do is provide a listing of those who've got credits available on our website with the contact information they've given us, and then people who are looking for credits go and look for, they contact those individuals and say, you know, I'd like to see what you have for wetland credits of this amount, and then they make a deal, and we actually have no information about that deal. They can trade money, they can trade property, they can trade, you know, anything they want to make that deal happen.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. So if I were to have the bank and I take my farmland and turn it into the wetland and sell the credits off, at that point my income is diminished to the point, if I sold off all my my credits, then I'm still paying a tax on that. What would be my incentive to continue to pay the tax if I can no longer receive income off the wetland? And in those cases, how much of that then becomes tax forfeit land, and where does that land go to then?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hancock, what you've described hasn't happened yet, so I don't know exactly, but, you know, again, the tax forfeiture issue is something that we haven't seen because of the following reasons. One, there are sub-parcel areas that you describe in this easement that would be available to be sold as credits. You know, if you're the seller in this case, you know, you've derived some income off of that, you know, and you have to, you know, save some of that income to make sure you keep that site, you know, functioning as is, because there is a conservation easement requiring you or your successors of that property to do that. Let me do a little more research, because I know we haven't had one happen. I think it's a hypothetical question about how it would be handled. I think the short answer would be the way any other tax forfeiture process would occur, if there was a way to separate that area from the rest of the parcel and go down that path. But we haven't had it happen yet, but it's a good thing to be aware of, so I appreciate you bringing it up.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Jasky, a couple questions in one, and then I won't have a follow-up. Just your run-of-your-mill project that you've run into, say down in Leichenmeyer, the Maple of the Cobb, or an established watershed with a protected creek coming through it, and it goes around a corner, the trees are falling in, the farmer complains, and you're worried about it changing the course of the creek and his land, and so you enter in a cooperative project to do some fixing up. How many agencies right now in that hypothetical do you think would be involved that would have to give the okay, is the first part of the question. And then over your years that you've been in this job, have you noticed less or the same or more involvement higher above your head? And in fact, your agencies having to go for okays like to the Corps or MPCA or EPA finally?
Director Jasky.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, let me answer the last part first. I think it's been about the same, actually, but what's maybe confounded a bit is a couple of things. One is, you know, there's been some court cases, Supreme Court cases in particular, that have changed the definition of, you know, waters of the U.S. to some extent, and that's the federal side of it, so it's more uncertain as to what their jurisdiction is. There's no more jurisdiction, it's more unknown about when they will exercise it because of that, those Supreme Court cases. On the state side, I think it's probably about the same as well. There's been no new laws or rules passed that would require any additional permitting that I'm aware of, although you know, there's been some federal responsibilities handed to PCA regarding stormwater and construction site that have evolved over the last, you know, 20 years. In the case you described, I got a mental picture in my head of that place you're describing in your district, but it was in a public water, and it was, you know, it was going to involve some form of excavation. The DNR would have to approve that. If it was in a public ditch, then it would be the ditch authority basically allowing you to do some maintenance. Those are fairly easy to determine because in each county there's a map that defines public waters, and there's a ditch map that also defines where those ditch responsibilities begin and end. So I think overall I would say it's about the same, although I think more people are paying attention to it. I think I will give you that list you described. More people are aware of these things and perhaps have comments about them, but the authorities I don't think have changed very much.
Director Jasky, hopefully you have Tuesday morning reserved on your schedule, because we'll continue then.
Mr. Chair, I'll be back.
For the benefit, we're adjourned.